It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Welcome back to the Women's Podcast. I'm Roisin Ingle. And of course, if this is your very first time listening or you've just started listening to us, we're really grateful to you. Thanks very much for choosing this podcast. This week, we are talking to the amazing and brilliant author Anne Enright, who has a new book out called The Wren, a book I and many others thought should have been included on the Booker long list, but wasn't.
The list is more or less a discovery list, which has been the case in the last few years of the Booker, because it's such an amazing PR machine. It's like It's almost a waste. It's such an opportunity to bring new voices into the public realm. So I think the judges have been taking that opportunity. And so actually that was the same impulse that brought my work to attention in 2007. So you say, actually, and people who go around complaining that they don't win prizes, I always think of Trump and Georgia. I say, no, you didn't win Georgia. You just didn't have the votes on the day.
That was Anne Enright there being very classy about her omission from the Booker long list, and more from her later about The Wren, which follows on from the success of her 2020 novel Actress. The Wren is a multi-generational story exploring family trauma and the love between mother and daughter, told through three members of the same family, Nell, Carmel and Phil. First, a couple of stories that caught our eye and our ears. I was listening to Labour leader Ivana Bacic this week on Drive Time on RTÉ Radio, and she was talking about a new report that has found that domestic abuse in Ireland is a leading cause of homelessness, especially among women. And that report was published by the Mercy Law Resource Centre, and it highlighted the difficulties around access to emergency and more long-term accommodation that victims can face when fleeing domestic violence. Bacic said the government was falling short of its obligations and made the point that legislators and those in government should look really closely at the recommendations in that report. So I hope that happens. And another story that caught our eye this week was a BBC report from Mexico, where the Supreme Court has decriminalised abortion nationwide. So it's good to hear some positive news around women's reproductive rights when in some parts of the world things seem to be going backwards. The ruling in Mexico, which is, of course, a predominantly Catholic country of 130 million people, points to how nations in Latin America are taking a leading role in broadening abortion rights. And Rebecca Ramos, who's director of a leading abortion rights group that filed an injunction last year against the Mexican regulation from 1931 that criminalised the procedure, she said this week, "I'm very moved and very proud. This makes possible what we had not achieved in many years, which is that at least in certain institutions all across the country, legal and safe abortion services can be provided." So great to see that happening in Mexico, and well done to all the activists there for all their hard work. In other news, I am going to see Barbie for the fourth time this week. I don't think I've ever gone to the cinema to see a film four times, and I'm trying to figure it out. I just really like that film. It makes me happy in a world where there is a lot you could be unhappy about and depressed about and angry about, especially as a woman. Greta Gerwig's film about Barbie's feminism, Kennergy and all the rest just brings me joy, and I'm not sorry, actually. It's just fantastic. I'm looking forward to seeing it for the fourth time. I don't know if Anne Enright has seen Barbie even once. I didn't ask her, but we had a wonderful chat anyway about her fantastic new novel, The Wren, The Wren. If you are a book lover as I am, a new Enright novel is always a source of celebration. She just has that incredible ability to pin down the human experience in ways that are familiar, moving, and also always deeply thought-provoking. This is another family saga. I just want to read you some of the things that have been said about The Wren, The Wren. It's a magnificent novel. Anne Enright's stylistic brilliance seems to put the reader directly in touch with her characters and the rich territory of their lives. That was from Sally Rooney, author of Normal People. A triumph. This is Enright's best novel since The Gathering, and its absence from this year's Booker's long list is nothing less than a miscarriage of literary justice. Readers must find it and treasure it regardless. That was a review in the Sunday Times. And Margaret Atwood has said that these pages practically crackle with intelligence and compassion. Just to give you the story of the novel before I bring you our conversation, which does touch on that omission from the long list of the Booker, which I personally found deeply surprising. Anyway, The Wren, The Wren is about three generations of women and the inheritance of trauma, but also about the inheritance of love and of wonder. The characters are Nell McDarrah, who never knew her grandfather, the celebrated Irish poet Phil McDarrah, but his love poems seem to speak directly to her. Restless and wryly self-assured, at 22, Nell leaves her mother Carmel's orderly home to find her own voice as a writer. She writes ghost blogs for an influencer, which is a very funny part of the story, and to live a poetical life. As she chases obsessive love, damage and transcendence in Dublin and beyond, her grandfather's poetry seems to guide her home. Nell's mother is a different kettle of fish. Carmel McDarrah knows the magic of her father's poetry too well, the kind of magic that makes women in their 90s slip outside for a kiss and then elope as her mother Terry did. In his poems to Carmel, Phil envisions his daughter as a bright-eyed wren ascending in escape from his hand, but it is Phil who departs, abandoning his wife and two young daughters. Carmel struggles to reconcile the poet with the father whose desertion scars her life, along with that of her fiercely dutiful sister and their gentle, cancer-ridden mother. To distance herself from this betrayal, Carmel turns inward, raising Nell, her daughter, and her one trusted love alone. The Wren, The Wren brings to life three generations of McDarrah women who must contend with inheritances of all kinds, of poetic wonder and of abandonment by a man who is lauded in public but who is carelessly selfish at home. Their other, stronger inheritance is a sustaining love that is more than a strand of DNA, as Anne Enright puts it, but a rope thrown from the past, a fat, twisted rope full of blood. This is, as the blurb says, sharp prose studded with crystalline poetry. Anne Enright masterfully braids a family story of longing, betrayal and hope. I fully agree with that endorsement. I loved this book and I loved talking to Anne because she's just a literary rock star, I suppose. I think she was called that once in the Irish Times anyway, back in the day. And she's now the author of seven novels, most recently Actress. She has been awarded the Man Booker Prize, the Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Fiction and a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Irish Book Awards. She lives in Dublin with her husband and two children. And I really hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. Anne Enright, delighted to have you back in this studio. We had you on before, but it was a live podcast with Cathy Sheridan from the Abbey Stage, you might remember.
I do remember it well, February 2020.
These were the days, the weeks before everything went.
Yeah, and we kind of had vague intimations in the corner of our eye. And I'm going, China, what? Italy, that doesn't matter.
Wuhan, what?
The 20th of February 2020, yes. And I liked the date. It had a nice kind of ring to it. And I loved the event. It was so nice to be in Liberty Hall with Cathy on stage. Brilliant audience and on we go. And then bang. It's like I was in America and the tour I was on, which was fairly closely planned, was falling apart just day by day. And I was due to go into the Harvard bookshop in Harvard Square. And I realised that Boston Biotech were a mile down the road. Looking it up and I said, why am I going towards this disease?
So it all had to be abandoned and you had to come home.
long drive home with a very coffee driver and a plane full of white, anxious faces.
And at which point then, like the rest of us, all locked down and many, many, many walks up Cliny Hill.
Yeah, I wish I was doing it now, actually.
it would be a great day to do it.
Yeah, lovely bit of weather.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was doing the plod, you know, I was putting one foot in front of the other. So, and if you ever went out in a car, which I sometimes had to go to my mother's, and you'd see everyone out walking, it was really nice and scary at the same time. So I went up Killiney Hill day by day, and the spring, that beautiful, still, strange, beautiful weather we had in April. And the spring started, the sap started to rise, and the plants all did what they ever they needed to do. And I found it immensely moving and significant and melancholy.
And the sap started to rise in you in terms of this new book, The Wren, yeah. The Wren.
Yeah, I mean, there was, I was going home and reading poetry, and I was going home and reading Irish poetry about little dead birds and having a little cry about little dead birds from the 9th century or the 12th century. That wonderful book on Dúnor, Poems of the Dispossessed, translated by Thomas Kinsella. So it just felt like the everythingness of everything was upon us all. And it felt a little bit like adolescence, where everything feels momentous and significant. So I started, yeah, I had a character called Carmel, or at least I had her problem in my head. And I didn't really want to be writing Carmel, to be honest, because she's a kind of tough-minded person and it was a tough-minded time. But we wanted to pull out of it somehow. So between those, the poetry and the kind of get on with it, the get on with it, the get over yourself of Carmel.
Yeah.
Which is very Irish style.
It
can be too harsh. You don't necessarily want it in, you know, a maternity nurse or something like that.
And
you can get it sometimes.
Are you a get on with it? Like, Carmel's very much like that. There's one bit where we can talk about the different characters, but her daughter Nell is telling her about a friend of hers who has anxiety.
Yeah.
And I love Carmel's response. She just sounds like she's stupid. What's wrong with her?
Yeah, she thinks the plane is going to drop out of the sky. And Carmel says, but the plane isn't going to drop out of the sky. And her daughter says, yeah, well, she knows that. And Carmel says, well, that's just stupid. Why do we have to do what's stupid people, you know, you have to, everyone has to do what I say now because I'm really thick.
Yeah.
That balance between practicality and pragmatism and toughness is one that is, I'm interested in for sure. I'm interested in kind of how we imagine and project. And if you take that away and look at things very simply and you say, well, this isn't the big problem you think it is. It's just a simple problem, actually. Get out of bed. Or whatever it is, you know. Say if you're looking at any of those things that we all suffer from, procrastination, whatever it is, and you kind of unpack it a bit. And I am interested in unpacking it, and I am interested in what is practically at the base of it. But if you live your life on that practical level all the time, you're depriving yourself of wonderful escapes and wonderful transcendence, but also empathy for other people. So it's not a compassionate way forward.
So tell us about the three voices in the book. So Carmel is one, that get over it kind of...
Yeah, get on with it.
Get on with it. Her daughter, who's this 20-something Insta, she writes copy for an influencer, which is a fascinating job and really... you do that so well, I have to say.
Okay.
It's brilliant. Okay. I loved her voice. And then there's Phil. So maybe you can talk us through.
Yeah, Phil is dead. That's the first thing about
Phil. Yeah, but he's a ghost over through with the whole thing, isn't he?
So he's not actually a character. He's a kind of series of texts, and those texts are his poems.
Yeah.
And his poems are in the Irish lyric tradition, and they go back to the 9th century, and they are about dead birds. And they have that lovely lyrical reach, that interest in nature, and all that kind of loveliness that Irish poetry can convey. He's not... and some of the bitterness too, you know, there's kind of a bit of the satire of Louis MacNeice in there and some of Michael Hartnett's translations from O'Brother, these curse poems and invectives. So he's not all simply lovely on the page, but he's not lovely at all really in life, I suppose. Or he's so in pursuit of his own loveliness that he leaves his family behind. So
yeah.
Carmel is the daughter of that family. And that's where her kind of tough-mindedness really kicks in. Whatever is going on with her mind, I'm more and more interested in the idea that people have different styles of brain, apart from, of ways of thinking now. It's not all psychology. Anyway, whatever that little child Carmel was,
yeah,
becomes a kind of closed down at that moment when her father leaves.
And then she has sort of, but almost by accident, I suppose, is the way to say, she gets pregnant.
Oh, accidentally on purpose. Actually, it's more like on purpose accidentally.
Yeah,
she decides that she's going to have a child on her own, that men are in general disappointing. And so she's not going to hand over her most precious thing to any man. And so she has her baby on her own.
And this is Nell, who we talked about.
And that's the wonderful Nell.
Yeah, because the book is very much about the dynamic between Nell and her as well. And those family mother-daughter things, you're fascinated by them. They're always there somewhere, I think, in your work.
Yeah, I mean, I head into it again. I think, oh, no, you know, oh, no.
No,
but they're all different.
Yeah.
Okay, because one thing is not often enough said. Women who have children are just people who have children, okay? They're not turned into this samey thing called mama, okay?
No,
they're all individuals.
I can attest to that from being on many WhatsApp groups with many mothers who are all having different styles of...
Exactly. Yeah. And it's not just that they are different people, they have different ways of bringing children up.
Yes.
And also, the thing I liked about Nell and that liking really carries into the book, I think, is that astonishing fact that that children come out as themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So from the day they're born and you look at them and say, oh, there you are now. There you are. Completely different to the last one I had. You know, whatever it is, that their personality. So that it is an interaction as much as, you know, it's more of an interaction than perhaps you think.
And I think it's lovely that they have a good relationship, I would say. I mean, would you agree or not? Do you think they have an abiding...
Nell
I
knows...
I liked it, like...
It's quite real at the end.
Yeah.
Carmel's kind of hard to get away from for Nell, and it's made worse or made more difficult or made by the fact that the relationship isn't triangulated with a father figure.
Hmm.
So it's just that dyadic, you know, it's face-to-face, basically, and she's trying to turn away and get into her own life, you know.
And it's interesting that for Nell, the poetry of her grandfather is much more sort of real in a way and much more present than Carmel, who's kind of, you know, because of the way he treated her and treated the family, she's kind of rejected this figure in the life.
Well, the problem with the poetry and his reputation is the fact that he's considered wonderful robs his daughters of the ability to be cross, properly cross.
So that's
they're not
so good.
They can't hate him properly. They can't feel properly betrayed because he's continuing to write this beautiful stuff. And that's seen as more important in society's eyes than his relationship with his children.
Mm.
So they're sidelined and their emotions are sidelined. So Carmel just doesn't do it.
Yeah.
She just isn't going to go there. Nell thinks her mother is the most boring creature who ever walked. dull. How, you know, she's made boredom her first occupation, says Nell. Mm. And there's Phil with these gorgeous, lovely poems that comfort her when she's sad. Mm. And she says, how did my family go from wonderful to dull in a single generation?
You know? He reminds me of, I don't know, you've probably been to Grogan's quite a bit, but you know the way sometimes you're in Grogan's and
I have or I haven't?
You have, I imagine you have.
You imagine.
I don't know, I have this idea of you that you've spent many an hour in Grogan's. No, am I wrong?
I wasn't an habitué.
Okay.
I went there recently, yeah.
Oh, really?
I met Bobby Bala in this, yeah.
Okay, well, I imagine you like sort of been there a lot, but I've been there occasionally. And
I was there a lot when Tommy was the barman.
Yes,
I remember
that's
lovely
kind
Tommy.
Of when I would have gone there. And I remember getting into conversations with sometimes poets, people like, I would say like Phil, but not as successful as Phil. But I felt it was a very real character. You know, these sort of people who are just very full of ego and full of the sense of their own self and boring, I found him.
You found Phil boring?
Yeah.
In what way did you
just
find
that
him
I just
boring?
Don't like? I didn't like him. I suppose I'm not boring. I just didn't like him as a character because of the way he was. Because of that two sided thing.
Yeah.
Look at me, I'm this brilliant, you know, man and world renowned, and he goes off and he finds another wife. You know, if that's okay to don't be too spoilery about it.
Yeah.
And then on the other side, he's all the things that say a poet who cares about things should care about doesn't, you know, or somebody who's artistic or claims to, you know, be lyrical and and appreciate beauty when it's right there in front of him in form of his own children or his own wife doesn't find them. So I suppose just in the way that you would want me to feel about him in a way, probably.
Yeah, or the way that Carmel might feel about him.
Yeah, probably. I probably was.
But, you know, I mean, I've been asked questions about the you know, the male monster artist and the narcissist, male narcissist monster artist. And, you know, Carmel... Phil does what artists do. He feels he has to do this thing, make these pieces of work, and he feels that the world might be interested in them. And for Carmel, that's an astonishing claim on the world's attention, okay? Because she's a get-over-yourself sort of person. She's a who'd-want-to-read-what-you're-writing sort of person. And so she, I mean, I didn't over-egg that, but I mean, she would have clamped down on all of that in her own life. She wouldn't expect anything from anyone. And I think that's kind of... tragic as well, you know.
He's a violent man as well.
He's an aimlessly, chaotically violent man, an anguished man. He's not a manipulative, deliberate, he doesn't engage in deliberate cruelty.
No, but violence is kind of part of his language in terms of reacting to things. I mean, this great thing about Austin Clark having this review of Poetry Review in the Irish Times.
Yeah.
Every Saturday they have to kind of hide the paper,
yes,
because in case his reaction to it, because they don't know what they're going to do.
That page is amazing. So you go back into the archive.
I want to go look at it.
You know, if you're looking
up
John McGahern, original kind of all the, if you're looking up what people thought at the time for controversies that still mean something to us, there's Austin Clark at the top left-hand corner, having an opinion about poetry every single week, and we knew his house. It was in Temple Oak. It was on the bridge in Temple Oak. And so it was known as the house of a poet. I mean, Mortimer Giron was also nearby, and that was another house of a poet in my childhood. Phil gets incensed and hurls a discus of dried cow manure out the window of Austin Clark's house in Temple Oak on the bridge. He's going up the Dodder. Actually, if you go back a little bit further, Phil has his own account of life in the country, in outside, growing up outside Tullamore. And that world celebrates violence. There's a lot of violence against animals in the book, if anybody, and purposely so. There are also some lovely relationships with animals in the book for later on. But so that's the kind of wellspring from which the rest of the violence in the book arises. And Phil's mother is a school teacher, and he says she goes off and her arm grows lean in the beating of children that were not her own. You kind of think that just violence was general, you know, that so and not even
across Ireland,
not notable. You know, it was a kind of throwaway joke. And in Carmel's generation, the violence is slightly comical. And of course, for children, it's always your fault if you get in the way of the violent, of the hitting.
Yeah.
You know, if you're hit at school, what did you do? That kind of thing.
Mm.
So he kind of flails around and they think it's like the weather. You just have to stay out of his way.
Yeah.
And but then when it arrives in the current moment, we see it very, very starkly. It's a kind of a tragic moment in the book. It's a moment of astonishing rupture. I won't give any more away.
No, but let's talk about
We see it for what it is, you know?
Yeah.
Not a joke.
Not trivialised, not kind of just something incidental.
Yeah. And then I suppose some part of you says, actually somebody asked, wasn't it better when we didn't mind?
Like when we could reduce it to just like Asher.
Asher, your grant, get on with it. Get over yourself.
So the other thread of violence in it would be with Nell, the young woman. So she's 20-something woman. I love her voice. She kind of reminds me of someone I might encounter in a Sally Rooney novel, and that's a massive compliment. And I hope
Thank you very much.
Take it like that, because I did when I started reading her. I was like, because she starts off, and I just get the name right. But going back to what you were saying about different psychologies, she starts talking about this Russell T. Hurlburt, the psychologist. And I thought it was a great way to set up her voice, because what he essentially finds is that people are different and they think differently. And of course, that's what a novel is. You're showing us all these people thinking differently about things and having different perspectives. But she's a really fascinating young woman because she's very, very smart. But she's also doing this writing copy for this influencer, which is a really interesting job. And she's kind of lost as well. What was your inspiration for her, or where did you come from? Kind of, I know some people have said to you, like, oh, writing this very young woman, but of course you can write anything because you're a novelist. You can write any characters of any age. But yeah, she's a very contemporary young woman.
Yeah, like, there's funny reactions, right? One is, how would you know about young people? And young people are quite territorial about their lives.
Oh,
yeah, because, I mean, it's axiomatic to the young that they might not be understood elders.
Yeah.
But I have never been old, and nobody's surprised if you write an old character.
Yes,
why would they, you know, of course you know what it is to be old, but actually I have been young. So it's not a foreign country to me.
I mean, suppose you've got kids around the same age as well, or similar ages.
Yeah, they don't line up exactly, but they have that kind of online ease. So they're not even the Facebook generation, my kids, they're the Snapchat generation. Mm. So they were over the first panic of how damaging it could be, you know.
Yeah. We're not still there. I sort of feel we're still in that.
Yeah, they're actually more savvy if you give them.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah, I hope. Mm. I hope. Touching all the wood.
Yeah.
So that kind of way of talking, I'm a writer. I'm interested in people being brief or going on at length. So I'm interested. Nell has a kind of cadence. She writes short pieces. But also I've been reading a lot of young women over the last few years and writing about them. And so people like Sally Rooney, but also Megan Nolan, Miranda Popke in America, and some others are talking about, I think actually there's an article in the Irish Times today about messy millennials having bad relationships. And I suppose it's a time of life where having bad relationships is part of the experience. That's, you know, it's part of the learning curve. Everybody's blundering around to a certain extent. It's much more kind of formalized now, with kind of the feeling of things being of a scene and people being online and whatever. So you worry about them, I suppose.
I thought it was really, because I've spoken to some young people in the last couple of years, young women particularly, about their sex lives, right? And a lot of what you have in there, in this really horrible relationship she has with a guy called Phelan, who I would just punch in the head if I ever saw him in Grogan's,
for example.
Yeah,
he's a bit tall, Roisin.
Oh, he's a bit too tall. I'm very short. Yeah. I wouldn't get near him. But anyway, he's just this guy who you just want to kill anyway. And she... There's this violent sex that goes on. There's kind of, you know, very coercive stuff, but just almost like that Nell is kind of a bit complicit in it too, or is sort of playing, is in that dance with him, and it's very well done, I have to say.
So complicit is a word that I've been avoiding.
Okay. Is complicit the wrong word, probably?
It begs too many questions.
Okay.
For me. But I mean,
you kind of want to shout at her to say, get out of that. She's there for it. Yeah,
she's there for it. Mm. One male interviewer said, but she's kind of into it, right?
Oh no, I didn't mean that. By the way,
but
sorry.
Sorry,
Nell, I didn't mean that.
But actually, by the end of that first section, which was emotionally incredibly sort of wrenching for me to write, by the end, it either works. It's like a switch that's flicked, so it's kind of binary. So it either works or it just doesn't work at all.
Mm.
Or it worked for 2 seconds and then it stops working, which I think is true enough to what I've read.
I suppose what I was getting at was that young people that I've spoken to, young women particularly, are expecting this kind of choking stuff to go on in sex, that they understand that they're in a heterosexual situation, that their male partner is going to have been influenced by this porn culture, that these things are going to be coming up when they go to have sex. And it really scared me, or shocked me, about the normalization of it, because I thought we'd kind of, you know, as women, kind of come to a place where we were going to be doing what we wanted in the bedroom or whatever, and there wouldn't be this kind of, it feels almost as if there's something else going on, where that there's a dominance that's happening more behind closed doors, and that's being accepted a little bit by younger women as part of the deal. And I don't know if that's a very sweeping statement, but I really...
No, you're completely right. I mean, it is kind of concerning. So if you see damage being played out sexually, you kind of think, well, it's not good for either damaged party to go to the dark side like that. Mm. But for men, it's hugely reinforced by several hundred million websites.
Yes,
okay.
Exactly.
So it is the women who are out on their own in that. It's not really a partnership of damage. or a mutuality of destruction. However, things like doomed love and mutual destruction go back forever.
Yeah. That's old school. We know that, but it's just playing out in different ways, isn't it?
And it's playing out in different ways in different spaces. Now, the thing about Phelim, if you read between the lines, which I hope people do,
yes, okay.
because my characters aren't, you know, are seen by other characters.
Yeah, so, of course. It's Nell's version of
So Phelim sits there and says at one stage, what are we doing?
I know, and babe.
Babe. And she's like, what do you think? What? What do you think you're for, as it were?
Yeah.
But also you probably ascertain he's got an online problem.
Yeah.
And that it's affecting his performance.
Which a lot of young men do. And it's
I don't know what the numbers are.
No, I think it's quite high. I think there's a lot of people. I don't know the numbers either, but I mean, it's definitely an issue.
You see, that's when I say I don't know what the numbers are, these are really interesting fictional spaces.
Mm.
And that's me saying, what's the reality? What is the reality?
Yeah.
I know you see articles and accounts from guys, too few, who are kind of pulling away from that kind of seam in their lives. Phelim goes on, or she intuits that he's going to go on to have a family and be nice, or nice enough.
Yeah, maybe he will.
Maybe he will. It's the brother, she says, you'd have
to worry about.
There's one brother who looks like a psycho.
But
and that actually is it, you know, with Phil as well. Phelim is more deliberate, but these men are more anguished than manipulative.
Hmm. Anguished than manipulative, yeah.
Well, Phelim just doesn't really think about it properly, I think.
I know, but I don't know. I think you're being very kind to Phelim. There's a bit where he's from the countryside and he gets her to go to the christening of his brother's baby.
Yeah,
but he says, get in the car, wear something nice, wear heels. Like a lot of what he does is just very, you know, not very nice or kind, or it's just dismissive of her, like disrespectful.
Yeah,
it's not just in a sexual way, it's in the general.
Yeah, well, she's a status kind of chick for him.
Yeah. Yeah, not fond of Phelim.
No, we're not fond of Phelim.
But that's okay. Not fond of Phil either, but very fond of Carmel
now. I'm kind of fond of Phil.
Let's talk about Phil then, because you had to become a poet to write this book. You write Phil's poems.
But I am. It's very hard to write characters without forgiving them.
Of course, yes, you have to.
I don't have to, because
I can just read it.
And part of the whole kind of narrative suspense is if the character you're on board for, like Nell or Carmel, starts to go wrong, you can say, please don't.
Yeah.
Please don't. And that's like a big kind of narrative push. That's what we say during horror movies, basically.
And there is one part where Carmel goes a bit wrong.
Yeah.
Very wrong.
Yeah.
And it's very disturbing. And hard. Yeah. I know it was hard for you to read the audiobook. I think that's what you were saying to someone recently. Was that bit you were talking about?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Yeah, I can understand it because I just read it again today and I suppose I don't want to say anything about it because the reader will get to read the book. But I read it again and just struck today how powerful it is, especially because we're rooting for her as a mother. We're rooting for her as a person in the world who's gone and had this child on her own, who's doing something
who
loves the child to bits and has done it despite all society's expectations and judgments.
There's a bit of that in there.
And then because she's still her father's daughter, you know. And it comes through there in that moment. But but talk about Phil then.
You said
you're fond with him, but also you had to become a poet to
write
about the
Phil,
book.
And the thing about Phil's poetry is that it's a reach. It's a reach for something higher. It's a reach for, say, you're laughing. Something higher, something more beautiful, something transcending, something lovely. It's a reach, okay? So where you're reaching from is always a good question. And he reaches from somewhere quite lowly. You know, he grows up in a thatched house, which we now consider cute, but they considered unhealthy. Two-room house.
Mm.
Everyone's sleeping in the same bed. God knows what went on. And so he's escaping from very lowly beginnings and making them beautiful and making them noble. And that was part of our post-colonial project, to make the lives of impoverished, colonised people beautiful and noble and heroic. So that's the reach.
That is the reach. But also, what about your reach of having to write poetry? Having not done it. I mean, you obviously appreciate poetry for a long time.
Yeah, I was very quiet about it. I mean, I don't kind of swoon. You know, I don't sort of take down a slim volume to swoon. I have had poetry with me all my life as, you know, a companion more than anything else. And so I suppose when it came to it, I knew more than I admitted to myself that I knew. But I felt like a complete imposter. And so I wrote something that looked like a poem, but I didn't think it was a poem. and then, I mean, whatever that is. So I reached out, as they say.
Yes, they do say that, don't they?
Yeah.
Reached out. They shouldn't say it, but they do.
Yeah, well, I did reach out to some poets I knew, Paul Perry in UCD and Jane Clark and Jessica Traynor. And you know, Jessica said, yeah, it's a poem.
You needed a confirmation.
Yeah. So I suddenly understood the confidence gap that I see every day with people who say, I wish I could write, usually women. And I understood what that confidence gap was, that they think there's some magic involved. I always say that, or I wondered what they thought writing was. Was it like flying or something? So I say, you know, you're building an airplane. You're not turning yourself into a bird, okay? It's like it's a mechanical, you know, that, you know. So I try to just damp down that feeling of, you know,
the sacred kind of text, or the
sacred, the other, the unreachable.
And yet you had that about poetry in a bit.
And
yourself.
I did, and yeah. I understood it then fully. Yeah. And then by the end, a couple of times I just wrote one.
just wrote a poem.
Which is a great sign.
Yeah. And so have you totally decided that's not, the sacred thing has gone from poetry now? I mean, as in, not saying that you don't appreciate it, but that it's the same as it's writing, and it's just in another form. You know.
Well, I'm interested in the ideas of the sacred, but and yeah, I think that kind of, I'd be a little bit intimidated by the amount of expertise around poetry. It's also about sincerity. I don't know what I'd write a poem about.
Yeah, I'd be interested to know you writing a poem as you, not as Phil.
Yeah,
would
no,
be interesting.
I mean, I did write a poem up basically from Killiney Hill about ferns and everything.
Okay.
And I decided it was too me and not enough Phil.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I've been reading a couple of poems recently by Pat Inglesby. Do you remember Pat Inglesby?
I do.
And he has just some amazing poems. I don't know if you like his work at all, but...
It's a real blast. Yeah,
because
he'd be on the telly and he'd be on the street.
He'd be on the street, you'd see him.
I don't think I've read them in a...
You should have a look at them. They're just very... I mean, a lot of them are just about people that he meets on the street or, you know, but they're... I suppose why I bring him up is because we can have this lofty idea of poetry, like it has to have certain sort of a feel that has to be very, highfalutin, with the want of a better expression, but it can also be very earthy and down to earth.
Sure.
Poetry, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I see. I don't know what kind of poet I would be if I was that poet.
Yeah, I wonder what poet you'd be.
I think there is a range of options.
I think you'd be funny and a bit, yeah.
Thanks. Thanks. I mean, I had somebody break up some of my paragraphs into lines once. That was very disconcerting, you know, and write them out as poems. And I thought, well, you have to move on to another writer now. Yeah.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Let's go back a bit on actually to your childhood, if that's okay. Because what reminded me was, because I was listening to your Desert Island Discs. Your brilliant, brilliant program that you did with that. I mean, that's such an honour to get on that, first of all. Did you feel like that when
it was such a moment, yeah.
Yeah, when you got the call. We would like you to come on.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's it. That's the definitive you have. You're successful, isn't it?
Well, that's what the publicist said.
Well, it's true,
yeah,
I think.
It's like we don't have to do anything else now.
But you were talking about at, because it was so interesting to hear about how precocious you were as a child, having read every children's book in the library by the time you were seven.
Yeah.
And then went on to the adult, like, reading Joyce and all of that. I think your first Joyce at 14 or something like that. And I hadn't really known all that about you actually before. And then you got a scholarship at 16 to Canada.
Yeah.
Whereupon you had a teacher, a poetry teacher called Theo, I think.
Yeah, an English teacher called Theo.
And you showed him your ghastly poetry, so that's where I was going.
Yeah, I did.
So it's funny, you know, that's
too well researched, Roisin.
Oh, well, you know,
I tried. I have those still somewhere.
Oh, now what are they like? What is that ghastly poetry? Like, you should have brought one in today. That would have been good.
Yeah, well, they're wow, my ghastly poetry. I suppose they were love poems, I suppose. And actually, I've incorporated one or two little things that remained from when I was 17 into subsequent books. I've taken some phrases from it. My goodness.
Mm.
Yeah, I must have a look. Maybe
I think you should have a look.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting to see. The other couple of things, you're the youngest of five, right?
Yeah.
So, and family dynamics are so important in all of your books,
yes,
as we know. And there was two things that stood out for me about what you've said about that your siblings gave you a typewriter.
They did.
I think at some point. They also gave you a book of Leonard Cohen's poetry called Flowers for Hitler.
I did, yeah, that was a big joke. That was a big joke. That was for my 13th birthday. Yeah. Or maybe it wasn't a joke.
That's
maybe
what I'm thinking.
But maybe I was taking myself very seriously. What a great present.
But did they they obviously then encouraged you in your writerly pursuits.
It was one of those, you know, robust Irish families. I mean, you didn't quite know if they were encouraging you or laughing at you. So, yeah, yeah.
And was being the youngest of five, obviously, must have influenced very much the fact that you write about families so much. I mean, that's, if we think of The Gathering, we think of all the families are very big in
the
your
thing
stories.
About Irish families, and again, I don't know what the figures are, but we tend to stay in them. We're a very family-based culture. So it was hard. It's hard for me to think outside of the family one way or the other, that people are connected in this way, whether they want to be or not.
Yeah.
So that kind of feeling of connection and separation is really key to, you know, what Forster said in the novel, only connect, you know, so it's a really good shorthand for your characters as well. It's a good stage. But all my families are different.
All your siblings are different.
No, all my
in the books.
fictional families are so different.
No, that's true, yeah.
Yeah. So, and also in Ireland, you know, your family has to put up with the fact that you're right.
And how do they cope with it?
They do it very graciously, I really have to say. Yeah, no, they're kind of amazing. Because people would say, oh, are you on the cover of that book? You know, they say, no, she made that up. And then I kind of fix the problem more or less by having so many different families in the books. The people now, and society is much more open and people are not as kind of pokey as they used to be, maybe.
Pokey, that's
a good word. Be poking and saying, is that you in that book? You know, so they're not as, they just have a bit more kind of...
more relaxed about it.
Yeah, exactly.
And talking about the mother-daughter dynamics, what was your dynamic with your mother?
Well, my mother, I think one of the key things you have to say about family dynamics and family pathologies is that the families I write about in The Gathering and in The Green Road have an unchangingness about them, that they are fixed in whatever their difficulty is. And that is the difference between a more or less healthy family and a more or less unhealthy family. So my mother is incredibly elderly now. She's 95.
And how is she?
She hasn't been mobile for a long time. So we've the last decade has been really, we've been in an elder care situation. And you kind of think how that alters your perspective on these relationships. You know what I mean? So it is really radically changed from when you're young.
Mm.
Individuals, people who are interested in themselves as individuals, might fix a moment in their past and say, this is what it was like, okay? So it might be a moment of grievance or it might be a moment of joy.
Mm.
But actually, I've been, 60 years in the same family, and it isn't the same with when somebody is in their 90s as it was when, you know. And, you know, so my teens were stormy enough.
Were they?
They were indeed.
Was that because you were a rebel and you didn't
conform? And I didn't conform. And also Ireland was changing in ways that seemed absolutely kind of apparent to everyone except your parents.
Yeah, but even you at 16, you went to Canada and you met someone who didn't believe in God and you were like flabbergasted.
Absolutely so amazing. He also believed in nudist bathing.
Okay.
Yeah, no, the two things are indelibly connected in my mind. He became a leading environmentalist and died last year, sadly.
Oh, yeah. Okay, you kept in touch?
No, I just know picked his up name. The news. He was in Newsweek.
Okay.
He became a famous environmentalist in his way. Anyway,
So do you think going to Canada and being exposed to the godless, naked people was...
He wasn't naked when he said in this conversation. Exposed to his
naked. I told you he likes to be naked with other people.
With his family!
Okay, with his family. Really bad. But did that... how much impact did that experience have on you, do you think, in terms of coming back and being nonconformist and all of that? Or were you already on the way?
Oh, no, I was very much on the way. And I was very headstrong and very strong in my opinions, and also, as time proved, more or less right. So I mean, my mother was at that stage very Catholic, my father not so much, and so there was that moral panic, basically, more or less, which was a panic, and it wasn't based on anything real or you know, whatever.
So, and the storminess, was that from that? Was that your mum's expectations?
So that would have that probably would have come later. She wanted conforming. She wanted conforming to happen. She was terrified of non-conforming, actually.
And how did you sort of not live up to that? Like, what was the worst thing you did, would you say?
I can't remember Russian. I can't remember. At 16, nothing too bad, I don't think.
Yeah, but as you got older, there was moments, I suppose, clashes with her and things that happened.
There would have been later on, yeah. Yeah, when I came home from Canada, I was very full of myself and I knew everything. I mean, I knew everything before I left.
Yeah, I was just going to say.
But when I came back...
You read every bloody book in the library.
I knew everything. Squared, you know.
So were you kind of insufferable to some people?
I suppose I was, yeah. I don't know. Insufferable. I was young.
And you, what age were you when you went to Trinity then?
So I would have been 18.
Okay. And I love the story of you meeting your husband. And I feel like it's a sort
English.
Of a start of
there's
a novel.
There's an Englishman at the end of this book. At the end of the Rendaren.
No, very nice Englishman.
A very nice
Englishman. I liked him a lot.
Yes, he's a decent person. And but Carmel isn't very keen on English people. So I did take that from my mother. She couldn't believe I brought home an Englishman on top of everything, you know.
But Carmel warms to this guy, so it's nice.
Yeah, yes.
So did
very
my mother. Quickly. Well, tell us about meeting Martin in Trinity.
See, that's the thing about these things. People move, people change. It's, you know, if you give them a chance, I suppose. Yeah, I met Martin in my first year in Trinity, his second year in Trinity. So we were in Players, spent all our life in the theatre, having a brilliant time. Like working all the hours. I mean, we still work all the hours, but it was fun.
And you auditioned for him. He was directing a play.
He was.
I want you to tell me the story because I just love it so much.
Yeah, I don't tell it that often, I suppose. So he was directing a play called The Freshers Co-op, I didn't know what that meant, but a fresher is a first year in Trinity and the co-op was a cooperative production. So you were guaranteed to get a part. Anyway, I auditioned for the part of Mrs. Brandywine, a neurotic housewife who is worried about her floorboards. And he wrote on his notes the word bingo.
With an exclamation mark.
Yeah, big exclamation mark, yeah.
Did that feature in the wedding speeches and all of
it
that?
It did actually, I think,
good.
Yeah.
Because it's so...
So we didn't get married. I don't know how many... It took us ages to get married and then it took us ages again to have kids. So we were not... It wasn't done and dusted.
But bingo sort of sums it up, though, obviously, the impression you made. Bingo.
Yeah.
It's nice to make that impression on somebody, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Bingo.
Bingo.
Would he have said that was sort of a love at first sight? I know it was bingo about she's perfect for
God,
the part.
I think I have his phone number if you want to ring him and ask him.
Okay, I might do that after.
Sure, it's here on my phone
and
somewhere.
And then you went off to university in England to
tell me what he says.
I will. I'll tell you. I'll let you know later on.
you went off to university, East Anglia University. But it didn't go so well, and it was only when you started to write short stories that everything...
So I went off. I went off and I left Ireland and I left everything. And I think that was kind of one of the factors, if you look at it, kind of environmentally. Mm. I was on my own in England.
Yeah.
With, you know, no money and no kind of idea of where I was, trying to write the great novel. Not the great Irish novel, Roisin Sáenz. You can laugh, but Ireland was too small for the greatness of my novel that I was writing in 1986. Yeah,
because it was it was on a few different continents.
Planets, worlds, whatever.
Languages.
Well, 18th century, sort of 18th century dialogue. Yeah, there was going to be a book in that.
Amazing. But that book never...
No.
So you came back home.
Actually, I have students now, and sometimes they wander off on a huge figari, you know, in the middle of their book. And I wonder whether I should call them back and say, could you just get back to that nice scene at the kitchen table? I kind of reassure them and say, no, you have to get it out of your system. It's going to be fine.
Okay. Yeah.
But I don't ever tell students what to do, which makes them very frustrated because they want you to tell them that.
Yeah.
So, but they can live through that frustration and find their own way, and that's all good.
And you just realised yourself that this incredibly expansive novel just wasn't going to work.
Well, I became sort of incapacitated. So I was living in a room where all the notes for this novel,
it was all crouching in on you.
It was like a scene in a horror movie where you... the walls were covered with plot points in different coloured biro and marker, and I was up all night. I wrote from 8 p.m. to 4 in the morning. I wasn't eating. I took no exercise. Didn't see fresh air. I just went off the bip altogether.
So you're like doing that tortured artist kind of thing.
I did, yeah.
And you were only like in your...
In my early 20s,
yeah. And so it just wasn't compatible with a healthy existence, it sounds like.
No, I mean, now we know that that's not the way to look after yourself one way or the other. So.
But then you didn't really know.
No.
And you thought you were on the right path that you should be on to a degree, like artistically.
Well, I was making my grand statement, yeah.
Yeah. And then when you came home, things clicked more with your writing.
I came home and I went up to Anna McCarrick.
The
Tyrone Guthrie Centre in Anna McCarrick. And I had 150, I think it must have been pounds in those days. It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
And I paid 120 to Anne McCarrick for my rent. And I wrote 4 short stories, clickety-click.
Right. So how did you make the decision to clickety-click and leave the other thing aside?
Yeah.
Was there a moment where you realised... This is not, I have to do this other thing, like the short stories.
I think it must have been unconscious. I mean, suddenly I was facilitated. I could just do it. It was just great.
And they got published.
And they got immediately published
by Faber.
Like, yeah.
What?
But actually, you put all that impulse in, right? I don't think work is wasted.
Yeah.
So first of all, psychologically, I could see what that sense of impossibility or overreach or whatever it was, what it had been, and the fact that it didn't finish me. That's really important that you survive some kind of what you would see as catastrophe and realise that it's not that goddamn catastrophic at all.
Yeah.
Nobody even noticed the book that you didn't write. Okay? Yeah. Nobody even saw the book you didn't write. And it's still there in some way, and that you can take bits of it and reuse and repurpose and be practical about it. So that was a useful thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you'd worked in RTE as well.
Yeah, no, and then I got a job in RTE.
Yeah, and Nighthawks. And people, I mean, some people listening won't remember Nighthawks, but I remember it was such a brilliant programme.
It was
so
great fun.
Original and refreshing. Like, and there's nothing
really
like
space.
It on RTE. I don't think there has been since like it.
No, they couldn't put up with that kind of anarchy on the airwaves. It was like anything
to be
said.
They didn't realise what they had or something.
Yeah, well, they said, go out and get young people. And I was under 25 when I went in there and I said, you are part of the new demographic, which is 50% of the country were young and under 25. So we were supposed to go out and get them, and fine, dib,
and
off we went.
It was great fun until it wasn't great fun,
there was a lot of work involved. Yeah.
Pressure,
but also I think slow institutional shutting down, so that facilities became harder to get. Money was, you were asked to do 40 more minutes for less money. Mm. So institutionally, there was quite a lot of kind of slow, I'd say quite deliberate running down of the people involved.
Yeah. And that wasn't good for you, and it wasn't good for your health or for anybody who was on
it. I don't think it was good for anyone.
And you kind of, you spoke about it on Desert Island Disc about how you were burnt out and all of that, but it opened up your path then to writing in another way. Like you went for it then.
I mean,
once you cleared from that space.
What we now know, I mean, language is great. I mean, it's one of my projects, through writing all these different novels is how new language facilitates insight. So at the time I thought it was a nervous breakdown or whatever. Now I say that was just total burnout.
Which we didn't have the phrase burnout. Yeah.
And a lot of the new language, it takes out the shame of the old, So
yeah, their nerves, like a woman's nerves were after them and stuff like that.
And your head is full of all kinds of everything, So it's really nice to have that clarity.
Yeah.
So people said, oh, you're very brave to leave a good job. I had a good job, but I was actually thought I wouldn't survive staying there, that I didn't have I didn't really have the option.
Yeah. And that's when writing became...
But I'd love to say that it was happy ever after, but the next decade was really anxious and I didn't know what I was doing. So, sorry.
No, but that's all part of it.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's worked out very well.
It's worked out in the long run. Yeah, thank you.
Let's talk about winning the Booker Prize.
Oh, yeah.
Your fourth novel was...
So that kind of turned the kind of... some of the difficulties around. Yeah.
It was like that. Was it life changing? That's what they say about those.
I was actually, you can make a story of it and say that I was completely unknown and then was suddenly in the spotlight. But actually, I was beginning to do all right. I had, for the pleasure of Eliza Lynch, what they called an advance,
Yeah,
it's hard to remember those days. There was you went into a bookshop and you picked out a book off the shelf and that's how you bought your books.
Mm.
So there was being unknown was a different, or being known was different to what it is now.
Yeah.
And actually in 2007, it was just the beginning of all of that kind of internet, slightly feral internet space. So, it was 2007.
And what would you say, looking back, did the Booker Prize do for you, apart from the money and the book sales and... For yourself, for your confidence as a writer?
Yeah, well, it did confuse me. For sure. And I found it hard to kind of get that, shake out that confusion and kind of get back to what I like doing and make a kind of safe creative space for myself again.
Because you were sort of more of a celebrity writer now, or what was the actual...
So I had readers for the first time. And actually lockdown was like the old days for me again, because the readership disappeared, the bookshops closed and I didn't know where we were. And it felt like being in my 20s again, and it didn't matter what I write.
Was that good?
It was nice, actually. It was, if you're taking the positives, that was a real positive. So after the Booker, there were all these readers. And actually when I went around and I travelled and I met the readers and I was really interested in, that was really nice, I have to say. Mm. I found the critical culture hard to negotiate. It's hard to be judged, always. I think
you
always.
You mean what people were saying about you having won the Booker or about your reviewing your books?
Just that sense of some kind of...
spotlight on you and people deciding what they
having
think of it.
Having a big judgy opinion about
you. Which you hadn't had to deal with before.
Hadn't dealt with that before.
Yeah, and it was hard, I'd say.
Yeah, I think it's always hard for writers. We were just basically, no matter how kind of no matter how showy-offy we are, no matter how we go around... selling ourselves, there is basically, it's you and the page in a room for years, They're not exactly invading foreign countries or anything. We're just writing our books.
And you have talked about other people's perceptions of it, and particularly men maybe looking at it and thinking, who's she, who's your one, or that kind of thing?
You do become alert to, some of the response to The Gathering from men was really... was kind of stinging or really strange, and stayed with me for a long time afterwards. And I didn't know whether it was because I had won the prize. I thought that was what it was, that I'd won the prize, and that was a real challenge to them somehow.
You winning was an injury to them,
They took it actually personally, like it was about them not winning, even though they hadn't written a book. I mean, it's hard to undo that kind of sense of connection that people come in with, It's like, actually? But a few of them were so wrong-minded or something. I thought that the content of the book, which contained sexual abuse of a young boy, that it might actually have spiked something in them, in them psychologically, because it was really toxic in a very few cases. And actually, when I talk about critical culture, and when I talk about more recently male critical culture, it is those. There is a certain thing that I'm trying to describe, which is this kind of real barb. That whatever it is, a real hurtful thing, sometimes a really damaged thing, and it can be a really misogynistic thing that comes out, and we privilege it more somehow as writers. If you're reading about your work and you get that somehow it's hard to forget. Put it that way.
We give it a lot of power.
But if it is a misogynistic, more or less misogynistic reviewer, the culture isn't going to call them out on that.
You know. And what I mean? Do you think you were the laureate and you spoke a lot about that kind of thing a bit more when you were that? But
yeah, Ireland is a little bit different. Ireland does silence, and Ireland does nice.
Silence and nice.
Yeah. So
you tell me a bit more about that, the silence and the nice.
So. When I was laureate, I was looking at reviewing culture, and what was clear was the absence of reviews of books by women. So that's silence.
Yeah.
And that silence was unnoticed, unnoticeable. Just nobody saw.
Yeah, and it that's just wasn't really interesting. Almost, or...
So that's so below the radar of the radar of the radar, you know, it's so regressed back. But it also does nice in that Irish men and women both are kind of encouraged to be charming. And encouraged to please, but it's much more so on women, I think, than it is on the men. Yeah. So it's like, why aren't you nice? It's really hard. It's really hard not to be nice.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, say, why aren't you nice to other cultures? They go, excuse me. And that's, what's that to do with anything?
Did you rail against that a bit in your life, do you think, since... you were younger? Like, did you have that feeling that I have to be nice? I have to be.
Yeah, I'm. No. I didn't. No.
That's what I mean. You didn't go down that I have to be nice.
Not in my work.
Yeah.
Not in my work. But I, you know, you make your life, you make your decisions. So you'd say you'd rather be more moral than not, or you would rather be more compassionate than not. Or think, do it like an adult. No, you're not going around trying to please everyone all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But
in my work, no, I never wanted to be nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you wanted to be real and truthful.
Yeah, sometimes I wanted to carry the emotion properly onto the page, which didn't involve. Nice. Thank you very much.
No. And going back to what I was saying about it, kind of, you wouldn't have said a lot about any of those subjects, about that kind of silence and niceness in the literary world. And then you did speak. Was it a sense that when you weren't talking about it, you didn't want to get kind of distracted by that or get involved?
It's really hard
that?
To pin down, right? If I make a general complaint about our culture, right?
Yeah.
People will say, well, who are you talking about?
Yeah.
You say, well, what about this guy? And they say, oh, him, nobody listens to him. Except. So it's very difficult to complain about a culture. Mm. And complaint is also a difficult mode.
Yeah.
Because women complaining are women unheard. Okay? That's why the word nag is only specific to women. It is unheard, it's unhearable, and it's annoying, and it's boring, and it's all the rest of it. So if you do.
So you didn't want to be a nag?
No, I wanted to be heard.
Yeah.
So what you do is you make. I just wanted to make safe. Okay? So if you're going to go out in the rain, make sure you have your umbrella and your sou'wester or whatever, your coat. So I did it more or less from a place of authority. So it wasn't a complaint, it was an observation.
Yeah.
And I didn't call out individuals. I didn't personalise it. I didn't, and if you want bloke language, I did it with statistics.
Hmm. And so that was very deliberately the way you approached it, because you knew that otherwise you would come across as, oh, look at your one just nag, complaining.
Yeah, well, you tell me.
Yeah, I think people would. I think you did it in a very methodical, clear-minded way. Yeah. And but I think also the fact that there has been so many women, Irish women, coming up writing around you now, you were sort of on your own as a woman to a degree, or not as other people weren't as prominent as you.
I don't know. You'd have to actually look at what was in the papers at the time, or if that is prominence. You know, I mean, I certainly didn't feel alone. There were very good writers, Mary Morrissey and Deirdre Madden, Eilish Ní Chaoimh. Now, these are all strong names, and I'm sure I could list more and more if I gave it a few more minutes. There wasn't a sense of hurrah about women's fiction,
right? That's
the way
there
is now.
And there really is now. And does that, is that gratifying for you? I mean, are you, I know you've done events with Sally Rooney, and there's like, I mean, Claire Keegan is amazing writer as well. And there's so many women in the north as well that I just love reading to hear a different story from that part of this country that we weren't hearing before. How does that feel as someone who teaches creative writing as well?
Well, the unstoppability of Irish fiction is now, you know, tilts female. It is in part to do with an empowered readership, in part to do with the kind of breakdown of authority that the internet gave us and social media gave us. So there was a sense of women taking the power that they already had in terms of they were the ones buying the books to in fiction, you know, maybe 60-40, 70-30 is female to male. Yeah. So that's all really brilliant. You might have 2 minutes where you say, where feminists of one generation look at the young ones and say, I wasn't in your way. Or, you know, whatever. But it's berbúa, basically, yeah.
And there's other people saying that, are sure, a white man of a certain age can't get a book published these
days.
There's all these women. I know, I'm just... I don't think it's true, but it's interesting that argument comes in, doesn't it? Like,
I mean, the thing is, for 2 minutes, you know, and for 2 minutes, women are doing well, and the men get immediately grumpy. Like, it wasn't me, I didn't do it, and it's not fair.
Yeah. It's true, isn't it, though? There is that narrative comes in.
Yeah, well, you know, grievance is an, you know, grievance moves around, put it that way.
Yeah. Do you like this bit when a book is just out and everyone's starting to read it and the people on the internet are saying what they think about it? And it, like you say, it is all much, it's very different to when you started writing.
Yes.
Everyone has an opinion and everyone's allowed to put it out there.
Yeah.
Do you read everyone's opinion?
I like to take the temperature, surely, of, I like to see what hits home and what is being missed, maybe. That's kind of for future reference. That's kind of part of the learning of the of being a writer.
Like, what parts of the book that maybe didn't land in the way that you thought they would?
Yeah, I am kind of interested to see what people see and isn't what I saw. That's always interesting, more or less. And, well, I tell you, like, it's actually kind of busy because it comes out in a number of different territories. So you're juggling bits of America and the UK and Ireland. And for maybe all of July, I was just braced for impact.
Yeah.
It's like braced for impact. I mean, I'm not very efficient. I'm not very effective. My emailing goes to pot. I am braced for impact.
Yeah.
And then so you have to find a moment where you say, oh, it's happened. Actually, I'm through it. Mm. The impact has arrived and I'm still standing. So that was about maybe this day last week.
And does it, I mean, I was very surprised your book didn't end up on the long list for the Booker myself. I was expecting it to be there because I read it a while ago and then I read it again. So I've read it twice because I saw Claire Keegan saying you should read every book twice. I mean, who has the time? But I think it's a good point because actually I got things from it the second time that I read it that I hadn't. So I think it might be right. But anyway, apart from that, you didn't end up on the Booker long list. And I wondered what that was like for you. Was it...
Well, the timing would have been nice, I have to say. It would have given the book a bit of a boost. So that's just logistically you go, okay. So that gamble didn't pay off one way or the other. But
do you look at the other books and go, why? How much thought do you give to it?
Well, I mean, I think people do think about these things and it would be wrong not to sort it out in your head somehow. But the list is more or less a discovery list, which has been the case in the last few years of the Booker. That they are turning up because it's such an amazing PR machine. It's like it's almost a waste. It's such an opportunity to right. bring new voices into the public realm. So I think they take the judges have been taking that opportunity. And so actually that was the same impulse that brought my work to attention in 2007. So you say, actually, grand.
That is very sanguine and diplomatic of you, Anne Enright.
Well, you know, prizes aren't magic, okay? It's five people in a room on a day, you know? And people who go around complaining that they don't win prizes, I always think of Trump and Georgia. I say, no, you didn't win Georgia. You just didn't have the votes on the day.
Yeah. So tell me about your life apart from the books, because you teach.
Yeah.
How long have you been doing that? And is that a source of great inspiration for you as well, to see all these younger people who are starting out?
I like fresh texts. Sounds a bit. Sounds a bit.
I know you're like, I like big butts and I kind of like fresh texts and I cannot lie.
Yeah, frankly, kind of it's a bit, this sounds a bit vampiric actually.
Yeah, I
love their energy, I have to say. And I do what I do, you know. I like reading their work and responding to their work. That's just literally all it is. You can't really, because I'm a different kind of writer, I don't plan my books beforehand and then write them to a plan. I grow them and so I'm not really a kind of simple technical teacher, put it that way.
I mean, other people do that, I suppose. You do something different.
Yeah, I do, I suppose, recognition. And I'm a great believer that the answer to your problem is already on the page. So you look at what you're doing and you say, well, what is it? So I have an extra eye there to interrogate what you're doing and say, well, you know, that's a bit like such and such.
Okay.
That which went that way. So you bring your reading and your reading expertise to it more than your writing expertise.
And are you working on a new book at the moment?
I'm not, actually.
Because it takes you a few years, right? It's a 3 or 4 year process usually.
Yeah. I like to say I'm monogamous when it comes to books.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Because I'm still with the Ren.
Okay. And you'll be there till the kind of the publicity cracks down?
Yeah, so maybe next week I'll be writing something else.
In The Green Road, you have this iconic scene, right, which is the Christmas shop, which I think since it was out, everyone talks about. And every Christmas, I kind of try to get it down and I read it from somewhere. And it just puts me in that frame of mind. It's a very frenetic scene, but it's brilliant because you perfectly capture that. I think in The Wren, there's a scene that is going to be... it's shorter, you probably don't know which one I'm going to say.
No.
But it just really moved me. And I thought, this is why Anne Enright is such a genius. There's the bit where Nell comes back after she hasn't been, and Carmel is greeting her at the door. And it's a reunion of mother and daughter, a sort of slightly ambivalent daughter, kind of, you know, slagging her mother slightly as she recounts it. But the way you describe how Carmel feels about that reunion and the kind of, I think you describe her as a lioness, and it's the way she's almost pawing her, but then after
licking her with the rug of her tongue.
I was wondering, would you read that little bit?
I could.
Because it's short enough, but I just...
So this is based on...
it moved me a lot.
So this is based on those animal reunion videos that make Nell cry.
Well, that makes sense, because it made me cry. That's so funny.
Because there's nothing... wilder, you know, than the donkey running up to the little girl.
I honestly didn't get that. So now I've got another thing in it. That's brilliant. But it was just very beautifully described. And
this is Nell coming back yet. Sorry,
yeah, she's coming back from her travels, from her adventures.
Standing at my mother's door, I unzip my small shell suitcase and open it out flat on the top step, hunkering down to root through my worn belongings. Under a tangle of charger cable, used underwear and sandals, I find my keys. I always do. The charm is a big neon yellow Tweety pie, one eyebrow cocked, cartoon wing hands on either hip. This is the look that rattles out from under beds and sofa cushions, the face spotted at a distance and while drunk across dance floors. The reprimand that always comes back to my hand. Tweety, who is a boy. I looked it up, has been with me all this time, holding the keys to a door on the other side of the world. And behind that door, my past. The lock turns. Why wouldn't it? And I stoop to drag my spatchcocked suitcase inside. The hall smells like a nice hotel, orange and bergamot, exactly the way it did on the day I left. At first glance, I do not recognise the neat white and indigo cushions on the hall bench, but of course they've been here forever. There was like a month of her life when Carmel knew what she wanted, when the things in shops made complete sense to her, and the house would be set in that month for years to come. I send a text. Hey, girl. After a moment. Hey, hey. Ding. Question mark. My messages to Carmel announce themselves to the tune of Oh Happy Day by the Edwin Hawkins Singers, a tech present from yours truly. Maybe I hear it somewhere about. Maybe not. I attach a quick pic of my right eye, looking quizzical. Behind me, the wedge of the fanlight in the hall. There's a thin-sounding scream somewhere outside. My mother's in the back garden. A silence. Another cry, this time closer. Ah! The sound of the back door opening, the huffing thump of Carmel taking the stairs, saying, oh, oh, and then arms flung wide. Look at you! And we are in the hug. As reunion videos go, this is the one where the grown lioness bounds up to the regular-sized human being to batter with huge velvet paws, lick with the rug of her tongue, and harmlessly gnaw. Though in my arms, my mother is smaller than she seemed on approach. She tucks in, and I graze her crown with the underside of my chin. Why didn't you say? I wanted to surprise you. I wanted to stay out of your clutches, big mama. Take the bus, take the taxi. Oh, no, not the taxi. Take the air coach, the ordinary bus. I can pick you up along the way. Or hang on, give me your flight number. I'll meet you there. Oh, 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 oh. My mother stops saying oh and pulls back from me. Look at you. She will in a minute go back to being a normal lioness. She will drop as though indifferent and prowl about the business of her day, which involves, in this case, checking out the guy beside me in the hall. Mum, this is David. Hello, she says. Pleased to meet you, Mrs. McDara. Carmel, please, you're very welcome, she says. Come in, come in, you'll have a cup of tea. Oh, Godmother, you sound so Irish, I say. How do you want me to sound? This is a very good question. After that first strangeness, I step through some invisible membrane, some resistance. I am home.
Love it. And there's so many moments like that in the book, and any Anne Enright book being out in the world, a new one, is a source of pleasure for so many people. So thanks so for speaking to us today.
Thank you.
That was brilliant Anne Enright there. The book is The Wren, The Wren. Buy it, read it, treasure it. And if you enjoyed this episode and the podcast, please do leave us a review or subscribe to the podcast. It really makes a difference to us. The podcast is produced by Suzanne Brennan and by me, Roisin Ingle, with JJ Vernon on sound. Talk to us on social at IT Women's Podcast or email us on the Women's Podcast at irishtimes.com. That's it for me. Mind yourselves, and I'll talk to you next time.